The recent riot at a prison near Kingman has renewed the debate over the costs and benefits of private prisons. And some say those costs and benefits are closely linked.
The way to save money on incarceration is to use it less and to use the alternatives that are more effective in reducing crime and are cheaper for taxpayers.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, a new campaign finance system for local elections, and Arizona mining town is ready to reinvent itself.
And for some photographers, this is the most wonderful time of the year.
Here I am getting ready to go to bed like a lot of storm chasers were the other night. I just happened to look at radar and I'm like, wait, there's storms. And I go out and shoot all night.
Plus, the Pac-12 goes green and we attempt the 7-10 split.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Looks like we are free of monsoon possibilities for at least the next couple of days. Looking for sunny skies for the rest of the day with a high of 102. Should be clear tonight with lows around 80. And then for the next couple of days, sunny skies, high temperatures between 101 and 104. Currently, relative humidity is at 17%, and it's 101 degrees at KJZZ.
Mosquito fogging has been scheduled in the Phoenix metro area. The summer's first confirmed cases of West Nile virus in Maricopa County were announced on Tuesday. The virus, which is caused by the Culex mosquito, has led to more calls for fogging in valley neighborhoods. Johnny DeLaunay with Maricopa County Environmental Services Department says its 750 mosquito traps test for three things that prompt fogging.
A, the trap tests positive for West Nile. Or if it comes back with 30 or more of the Culex type of mosquito, or if it has 300 plus of any combination of mosquito species.
DeLaunay says the recent round of fogging is acting as a preventative measure to kill the mosquitoes that could potentially carry the West Nile virus.
A 2014 state law that makes it a crime for jilted lovers to post nude photos of their former partners online will be permanently blocked from enforcement under an agreement between the ACLU and Attorney General Mark Brnovich. Legal documents filed in U.S. District Court today include a proposed order that will prevent prosecutors from ever enforcing the law. U.S. District Judge Susan Bolton still has to sign off on the deal. Bolton blocked enforcement of the law last year after the ACLU sued, pending changes made by the legislature, but lawmakers failed to approve the revised bill.
More than 1,100 inmates from a private prison near Kingman have been relocated after disturbances and riots left parts of the prison uninhabitable. The Arizona Department of Corrections will be investigating the incidents, which have renewed debate over the use of private prisons and incarceration in general. We'll hear two perspectives today, starting with Caroline Isaacs, program director with American Friends Service Committee in Arizona and a supporter of criminal justice reform.
We're certainly pleased that there will be an investigation, and any oversight is better than no oversight, which is what we've had recently. We are concerned that giving this investigation power to the Department of Corrections, which in itself should be investigated in terms of its failure to monitor its contracts, would be counterproductive. So we sincerely hope that the governor and others would take an independent look, not just at this facility, but at the state's private prison contracts as a whole.
One of the things that we hear from legislators and other supporters of private prisons is that they really save the state money, that the state doesn't have to do all this itself. If the state were to stop using private prisons, do you think that Arizona would be spending more on corrections and incarceration?
It's really not an either or. First of all, there is no proof that any of these facilities are saving money. And the few reports and investigations that we do have from the past have shown the opposite. What we need instead of a public versus private prison is fewer prisons. The way to save money on incarceration is to use it less and to use the alternatives that are more effective in reducing crime and are cheaper for taxpayers. Things like drug treatment, mental health treatment, addressing the root causes of crime rather than simply trying to incarcerate our way out of these social problems.
How does Arizona do in those areas?
Horribly. We have the sixth highest incarceration rate in the country, and I don't think anyone would argue that Arizonans are any more criminal than the inhabitants of any other state. It's really a choice that we make in terms of our sentencing laws. We have a bulging private prison, a bulging prison system, a corrections budget that's siphoning money out of education, out of welfare and social programs, and out of other things that people need in this state for their own welfare. It's time to take a look at this system and right-size it so that we are using our scarce resources where they really need to be used, on the people who actually need to be separated from society for a time. And we can do better with fewer resources with actually addressing the root causes of crime.
A few years ago, as you know, there was an effort at the state legislature to do sentencing reform, and it really went nowhere. And it really hasn't even come up as an issue to be debated since then. Do you think that there's any hope that it could be?
I think it's only a matter of time. If you look nationally, the majority of other states, including very conservative states with very conservative leadership, South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama most recently, Utah, have taken a look at their sentencing systems and said, you know, this really isn't working. We all know, we all want the same things. We want greater public safety, we want less crime, and we want to spend money on things that are shared priorities for the people of the state. We can do all of those things, and other states have done it and seen actually greater decreases in crime than we have. It's not a new concept, it's not a radical concept. It's working, and there's evidence-based scientific tools out there and models that we can use.
Caroline Isaacs is Program Director of American Friends Service Committee in Arizona. She's based in Tucson. Caroline, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
There are also people in the law enforcement community who'd like to see reforms in the area of criminal justice. Yavapai County Attorney Sheila Polk is one of them, although she doesn't have a problem with DOC doing the investigation into the Kingman prison unrest.
Well, I think the State Department of Corrections clearly has a lot of experts that work with that department, and it's appropriate to have the experts doing this investigation.
Are you comfortable with the number of people that are getting locked up in Arizona? I mean, are there too many prisoners in this state?
I think the question to ask to start with is who's in our prisons, and if you were to open the doors, who is it that you would let out? So if we look at who is in our prison as of 2014, 95% are violent or repeat offenders. Another 11% are criminal aliens. And what we've been doing in Arizona is looking at who we're sending and trying to make sure that we're sending the right people for the right reasons. I actually would love to see some reform in the criminal justice system. The reform wouldn't focus on trying to let folks out who are there, but I think we can do a lot more in terms of front-end reformed, and I think we can do a lot more in terms of back-end reform.
What kinds of things are you talking about?
Well, let's talk about front-end reform to start with, and that would be trying to do more in our communities to keep folks from entering the criminal justice system in the first place. It's accepted that most of defendants who end up in prison have a drug or alcohol problem, yet I don't think we do nearly enough in our communities in terms of prevention. We're doing a lot now in terms of drug courts and diversion programs, trying to keep folks who have entered our system from going into prison by putting them in these courts where we get them treatment and counseling, and we bring them back into court and we hold them accountable. And so that's good. I'm all for our drug courts and our diversion programs, but I'd like to see us take a step further back and look at prevention, because I don't think Arizona does nearly enough in terms of prevention. I think we need to figure out what to do more with the mental health population, trying to keep folks with mental illness who perhaps have gone off their meds, trying to keep them from entering our criminal justice system.
When you talk about back-end reforms, is that an effort to prevent people who have maybe been to jail or prison from coming back?
Exactly. Those would be programs such as reentry programs where, in Yavapai County, I started our own program. We call it our Yavapai Reentry Program. We reach out to folks who are leaving Department of Corrections. We offer them the services of our reentry program, which consists of a mentor in our community and assistance with gaining meaningful employment, finding stable housing, access to food, access to health care. and that positive mentoring relationship. And those who have taken advantage of our reentry program, they have a lower recidivism rate than those who do not.
Do you think the incidents recently at the prison in Kingman will spur a kind of discussion at the state level about corrections and prisons in general, which could lead to more discussion about some of the issues that you're talking about?
There's always discussion going on. I know the legislature is always looking at, if nothing more, you know, the budget and how much money is spent on corrections. I think there's a lot of folks who are open to the idea that we can do more at the front end and that we can do more at the back end. And I think those definitely are important discussions to have.
As part of some of the changes that you've been talking about, do you think that Arizona needs to look at its sentencing laws at all?
I do not, because personally, I've been around long enough that I was there when truth in sentencing was imposed. And to me, truth in sentencing is sacred, and we should never abandon it.
Yavapai County Attorney Sheila Polk. Sheila, thanks.
Thank you, Mark. It's my pleasure.
The Tempe City Council next month is likely to consider a proposal to implement a public campaign finance system for the city. If the council approves it, Tempe voters would see the issue on the ballot, possibly this coming March. Councilman David Shapira is behind the proposal, which is based on Arizona's clean election system.
I had the opportunity to use it each time I ran for the state legislature. And when I went to the Tempe City Council, of course, I didn't have the option, nor does anyone have the option to run under a system where you're not having to raise these high-dollar private contributions. And so, you know, I really wanted to replicate the system that we have at the state level, where legislators are able to be elected without being beholden to lobbyists and developers. And so we're considering doing something very similar to the state clean election system at the city level in Tempe.
What would be similar to the state version, and what would you maybe have to do differently based on the size or the fact that it's not the state?
Well, much of the system will be very similar to the state system. At least that's what we're proposing. One of the benefits, let me just say, of trying to mirror the state clean election system is, as you know, it's been battle tested. The state system has been tested at the local and state court level. It's been tested at the U.S. Supreme Court. And so there, the provisions of it in terms of the compliance with free speech provisions of the Bill of Rights, again, are very tested. And so if we're able to replicate the state system, then we can create a system that will hold up to court challenges. Now, there are some things, as you noted, that will have to be different.
Where would the money to pay the candidates come from?
We also we structure that in a way that's very similar to the state system. And so one of the things that the state clean election system and its advocates are very proud of is the fact that it's not funded with taxpayer dollars. It's funded by fines and fees. It's funded by donations. You can donate on your tax return. If a candidate violates the rules of the system and has to pay a penalty, that goes into the coffers of the state clean election system. The city system is going to be very similar to that. So what we're planning at the city level is to add a $5 fee onto court fines and fees, which would raise about $100,000 a year, which would be about $200,000 per election cycle, which we think would be sufficient to fund our system.
I was going to ask you, what does it cost to run for Tempe City Government?
So we did a backwards analysis and went back and looked at previous election cycles to see what the winning candidates would spend in city council and mayoral races in the city of Tempe. And the proposal that we're coming out with, and this will be changed in future years depending on what the needs of the city are and what inflationary costs there are, but the initial amount that we're talking about would be $25,000 per election for council candidates and $50,000 per election for mayoral candidates. So, for example, last year when I ran, I was elected in August. I was not on the November ballot. I would have received $25,000 for that whole election cycle, which is actually pretty close to what I had to raise independently. If I had a runoff, I would have received $50,000.
Once the U.S. Supreme Court a few years ago basically did away with matching funds in the state clean election system, where if I was running clean and you were not, and you spent more money than I was able to raise, I would get the money to make up the difference. Many fewer candidates ran using clean elections. So why would you be optimistic that candidates for city council or mayor would use that kind of system when there are basically limits on how much they can spend?
It is true that with the McComish decision and the elimination of the matching funds provision at the state, it did become more difficult to run as a clean elections candidate. And I can tell you that from experience. If I could go back and do it over again, I would still run clean, Mark, because I believe, and I think the candidates who will choose this system will believe in the idea that politicians should not be beholden to those who fund their campaigns. And so even if it puts you at a competitive disadvantage, it's worth it to many candidates to say, I don't want to have people feeling like I owe them all these favors because they funded my race. And so I think candidates will still take advantage of it, even though in some cases it'll put them at a competitive disadvantage.
Tempe City Councilman David Shapira. David, thanks.
Happy to be here.
Still to come, a new children's hospital is opening in Mesa, and it's seen as a complement to similar facilities in the Valley, not competition.
It's very, very scary to have a sick baby or a sick child, and so sometimes when their illness is going to cause them to need medications at home or equipment at home, it takes time to learn those things, and it takes time to be confident.
How the new hospital could give families that extra time is ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. We've got some thick, fluffy clouds around the valley at this hour, but no mention of rain in the forecast for either this afternoon or this evening. Look for clear skies tonight and lows around 80 degrees. And then for the next couple of days, we'll stay dry. Expect sunny skies with highs from 101 to 104. Currently, relative humidity is at 17%, and it's 101 degrees. In valley traffic, there's a collision I-10 eastbound at 27th Avenue. It's blocking the shoulder and causing a pretty heavy backup for a couple of miles. It's the show on KJZZ at 220.
KJZZ is supported by the Commemorative Air Force Museum preserving combat aircraft in flying condition. Warbirds and historic exhibits are displayed indoors. The museum also is available for events. Photos and seasonal ride info at azcaf.org.
This week marks 20 years since the Srebrenica massacre in Bosnia. Bosnian Serb forces killed more than 8,000 Muslim men and boys. Many in the international community consider it a genocide, but yesterday Russia vetoed a UN resolution to formally designate the events as an act of genocide. Here at home, U.S. officials are taking steps to identify and deport Bosnian Serb immigrants who they believe took part in the Srebrenica massacre. But as KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block reports, there are some questions about who should be held accountable.
18 years ago, the U.S. government approved Vitomir Spirik and his wife and daughter to come to Phoenix as refugees. They're Bosnian Serbs who'd been displaced by the Bosnian War.
We are starting to live nice life. Nice life, everything is nice, everything is perfect, we find a good job.
He managed the bakery at a supermarket. The family began to put memories of the war behind them, and there were many memories. When Spirik was 20, mounting ethnic tensions forced him to flee his hometown of Zenica in Bosnia. He remembers seeing a spray-painted sign.
He say this is a Muslim country. Serb and Croatian, you must leave.
It was 1992. He says he was at a Red Cross shelter when recruiters from the Bosnian Serb militia picked him up and forced him into service. He says he didn't want to fight Muslims. He felt he'd already lost everything.
What to fight for?
He says he kept trying to run away, but the militia kept dragging him back. A few years later, Spirik made it to Serbia and applied for refugee status in the U.S., but he didn't disclose his time in the militia on the form. Then about a decade ago, U.S. immigration officials discovered his name on the militia's rosters, and Spirik's American dream came crashing down. He was prosecuted for making a false statement on his immigration forms and put in deportation proceedings. According to the U.S. government, Spirik may be a war criminal who helped the Bosnian Serb militia carry out the Srebrenica massacre, which Spirik denies.
You know, that is too hard. That is too hard because when they actually tell you you're guilty for something what you not did.
It's natural for someone to deny participation in one of these events.
Jennifer Elzey is a spokeswoman for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The agency has initiated deportation proceedings against about 150 Bosnian immigrants suspected of war crimes. Elzey says the government moves to deport immigrants when there's evidence they participated in human rights violations, like extrajudicial killings or genocide. though she says participating can also mean standing guard or driving prisoners into areas where the killing took place.
So there are many ways that people could, unfortunately, assist with these types of violations and not have pulled the trigger themselves.
She says the U.S. can't be seen as a safe haven for human rights abusers abroad. But in these deportation cases, the government just has to prove to an immigration judge that someone is deportable, not that the person is actually guilty of participating in a war crime. Attorney Chris Brelge argues some of these deportation efforts are unfair. He chose to represent 18 Bosnian Serbs he believes did nothing wrong, including Vitomir Spirik. He says all of them have similar stories.
They were ethnically cleansed by Muslims from Muslim-dominated areas. There was ethnic cleansing on all sides. They're refugees who are now being punished for something they didn't do. And they're being labeled as war criminals. I guess that's the part that is particularly distressing to me.
Brelge acknowledges in other cases, the U.S. does have solid evidence of war crimes. Some deported Bosnian Serbs have gone on to be convicted of those crimes in Bosnian courts.
I'm 100% behind removing people from the United States who committed war crimes, who participated in persecution. On the other hand, we shouldn't let the enormity of what happened there cloud our vision so that we can't discriminate between those who actually did commit the war crimes and others who have very clear, consistent, coherent, and credible stories about where they were and what had happened to them.
ICE wouldn't comment on individual deportation cases, but according to court documents, the U.S. government's main evidence that Spirik may have been involved in Srebrenica is the fact that his name is listed on the July 1995 roster for a particular battalion, and the government says that battalion assisted with the Srebrenica massacre. But Spirik says he wasn't even fighting that summer.
And in the July, what happened in the Srebrenica? In the July, I am in the hospital.
Spirik says he was hospitalized for a nervous breakdown and had no clue about the mass killing. His lawyers argue a symbol on the rosters confirms Spirik was on sick leave all summer. An immigration judge's opinion said there was a possibility that Spirik's account could be true, but the judge said Spirik should be deported for lying on his refugee application. Spirik said he was just following the advice of the refugee caseworker, so his application to the U.S. would be accepted.
They filled the paper for me. I'm signed.
They filled it out. He signed. Spirik will be sent back to Bosnia unless he can convince the immigration judge that deportation will cause too much harm to his son, a U.S. citizen. Meanwhile, Spirik wonders how he'll clear his name. He feels he's been labeled a war criminal without ever being tried or convicted of committing a war crime. Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Some Bosnian refugees here in Phoenix lost relatives in Srebrenica. Members of the Bosnian Muslim and Bosniak community in Phoenix will gather on Saturday to remember the 20th anniversary. Esad Boshkailo will be there. He was a doctor in Bosnia who spent a year helping civilians and soldiers on the front lines in the war. After he was captured, he spent about a year in six different concentration camps. He's now an associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Arizona and co-author of the book Wounded, I Am More Awake, Finding Me After Terror.
I frequently think about myself as a unique psychiatrist, as having this type of experience, and I decided to use this experience to help others. And I think I do have something unique to offer to my patients.
Do patients like hearing about your perspective as opposed to just sort of talking about what they've been through?
I do not share my story with my patient. They don't need to know this. It helps me as a survivor of several different psychological traumas. It helps me understand them better. It helps me understand difficulty of the time they are going through and helps me to give them some idea how to deal with trauma and how to find meaning after trauma.
Do you find that it can be difficult to, A, get people who have gone through a trauma to come to see you in the first place and then get them to open up and talk to you once they're there?
Yes, this is one of the most difficult part of the therapy that I'm doing. Trauma, it's insanity. And when a person is traumatized, they lose trust. in humanity. They lose trust in another human being, thinking how somebody can torture another person. And going to talk to somebody about it is extremely difficult because you don't have a trust. So my first session, several sessions, I'm using to get the trust of the person.
How do you do that?
I think that my traumatic experience helps me the most. When I say something that is extremely significant about feeling losing trust, when I say it, they hear somebody is understanding. Another person who did not go through, they can also be good therapists and psychiatrists. I'm not saying I'm only one who knows, but I may do things faster. When I say something very specific about trust, I feel them. They are going to talk to me.
So after what you went through, how did you come to trust people again?
It took me years. It took me years because trauma itself has to be processed in somebody's mind, either by talking, either by thinking, either by writing or sharing the story. It's a process. So it took me probably 4 or 5 years to trust again.
Why, in your mind, is it important for victims of this kind of trauma, or any trauma really, to express it? I mean, why is that important in order to be able to move on?
Expressing in a way of talking in psychotherapy or writing or thinking is a process. You have to process what happened to you. Without processing, it's going to haunt you all the time. If when you process it, put on the right place in the brain, understand it, and leave it there. It's going to stay forever, but the concept is I have to live with it. I have to learn to live with it.
Do you find that you have patients who aren't able to move sort of beyond that processing? It's sort of the talking about it or the writing about it or the thinking about it kind of overtakes them?
Yes. I have patients who never actually told me the story. I just know about trauma. They said something like that, and I never inquire. I don't think that's important. It's important that we are talking, that we made a relationship, and then I show understanding, and they see another human being across them, and I help them to accept what happened to them, whatever happened to them. I don't need to know details, and then leave it at.
Do you think that in any way your study of psychiatry and sort of coming to understand all of this helped you process what you had gone through?
Definitely, definitely. And I used techniques comparing somebody else's story. If I have a patient in Chicago that had worse story than mine, it makes me feel a little happy. It is now when I think about it, it's a little selfish statements, but that's what helped me.
Esad Boshkailo is an associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Arizona and co-author of the book Wounded, I Am More Awake, Finding Meaning After Terror. He'll be speaking at Saturday's event, which starts with a walk to remember at Civic Space Park and includes a commemoration program at Burton Barr Library.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
And my name's Barbara, and I'm at Let It Roll Bowling Alley. I've bowled for 50 years, and I love it. It's just one sport that I've always really enjoyed.
Well, I come because my wife always comes.
Hi.
I call myself the official cheerleader.
Hey! A lot of these people all bowl on different leagues in the winter, so you get to meet newer people, you know, that you've never seen.
It's good exercise for those that are doing it because a lot of us are getting older. I mean, when you've been bowling 50 years, you know, you're not a spring chicken anymore.
Just follow through. That's all I can tell you. That's what I've learned over 50 years is just take your time, get your rhythm, and follow through.
That was Barbara Marshall bowling and her wife Nikki Marshall cheering her on at Let It Roll Bowl. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
Still to come, how one business near Lake Mead is making the best of the drought.
That plane has never seen air since 1948. Everything in there, every control that's inside of it, is in its original position.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. Quick check of Valley traffic shows an accident on I-10 eastbound. It's at 27th Avenue, blocking the shoulder. Look for sunny skies to continue for the rest of the afternoon. Very, very slight chance for some afternoon storms. We're looking for a high today of 102. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows right around 80. Sunny and dry for the rest of the week into the weekend with highs between 101 and 104 each day. Right now in Phoenix, relative humidity 17%. Sunny skies, 101 degrees at KJZZ at 2:34.
KJZZ is supported by AZ Kebab House, located near Harkins 101 off of Mayo in Scottsdale, serving Chef Arif's authentic Persian dishes, fire-roasted gyros, chicken, beef, and lamb kebabs, fresh baklava, and tea. azkebab.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Federal Office of Personnel Management has acknowledged that hackers who broke into the agency's computer networks last year have obtained sensitive information about 21.5 million people. NPR's Brian Naylor reports the information stolen included Social Security numbers.
The Office of Personnel Management says 19.7 million people who underwent background investigations for government jobs had their records stolen, along with 1.8 million of their spouses and dependents. Those records include mental health and financial histories, and in some cases, fingerprints. It affects anyone who had a government background check dating back to 2000. And it's in addition to the several million current and former government employees who had their records stolen in a separate OPM breach. Congressional critics are renewing calls for OPM Director Catherine Archuleta to step down or be fired. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
Marine General Joseph Dunford, who's nominated to be the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says Russia, more than any other nation, poses the greatest threat to the national security of the U.S. Dunford was testifying today during his confirmation hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee. He said without lethal arms from the United States, Ukraine is not going to be able to defend itself against Russian aggression. So far, President Obama has resisted sending such weapons to Ukraine. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has signed legislation that will have the Confederate battle flag permanently removed from the grounds of the state capitol.
When the emotions start to fade, the history of the actions by everyone in South Carolina to get us to this moment is one that we can all be proud of.
The flag will be removed in a ceremony tomorrow morning and sent to a state military museum in the capital, Columbia. This is NPR News from Washington.
The Valley will be getting a new children's hospital. Hacienda Children's Hospital will open in Mesa later this month. It'll be 21,000 square feet with 24 private rooms, along with playgrounds and courtyards, among other features. Jennifer Frost is the administrator and director of nursing for Hacienda Children's Hospital.
We actually see patients for everything from simple infections to car accidents where they've had horrible injuries and they need time to recover. So we have a hospital down in Phoenix also that's been there for 21 years. And so historically we've seen, again, premature infants that just need some more time to feed and grow, all the way to patients with that had an open heart surgery that need some more time to heal before they can go home.
Where do you think that this new facility fits in with sort of the overall industry of children's hospital and children's medical care in the Valley?
Where we've always fit in and been great at is educating and giving the families time to kind of process everything. It's very, very scary to have a sick baby or a sick child. And so sometimes when their illness is going to cause them to need medications at home or equipment at home, it takes time to learn those things and it takes time to be confident. And so what happens sometimes is if they leave the larger hospital, they're maybe not 100% sure of the care that they need to give their child. And so if they leave that larger hospital and come here before they go home, it's a smaller setting, it's more intimate. It gives them more time to be independent with their child. We still provide round-the-clock nursing care and have physicians here, but because of the size, the parents have a lot less interruptions in the room. There's a lot less going on here. And so they're able to practice those cares, practice giving those medications so that when they do go home, they feel comfortable, they're confident, and that leaves the child much less likely to go back to the hospital.
Do you find that families tend to come to your hospitals after they've been to another hospital, be it a regular one or a larger children's hospital?
Yes, that's typically how they're referred here. A patient goes to a large hospital for a procedure or an illness, and what happens is during that course at the larger hospital, it becomes apparent that the family needs more time to adjust or that the patient may take a little bit longer to heal for whatever reason, and so then they refer them here. When you're really sick, you need to be in a big hospital, but when you're stable and you just need some time to recover, you really don't need to be in a huge hospital with all the emergency equipment and all the different things. And so this is a great place for a family to come and heal.
It sounds like you're describing Hacienda as sort of a supplement to a place like Phoenix Children's Hospital as opposed to a competition with it.
Exactly. And we know the folks at Phoenix Children's, we know the folks at Cardin's. They've been very supportive of what we do because they understand that there's definitely a place for us in the community. They love sending their children to us because they know that they don't need to stay in a huge hospital if they're just recovering or they just need some more time. And it also, importantly to the medical community, it makes room for the children that are really critically ill and really do need to be in the big hospitals.
What's the average length of stay for patients at your hospitals?
Typically, at this setting in our Phoenix location is about 10 days. So I anticipate something similar here.
Does this kind of setup exist in other cities where there are sort of the big children's hospitals and then some smaller ones that sort of serve as maybe a meeting point or a resting point between the big hospital and families going home?
Not in Arizona, no. In other states, I've seen there's a few different places. Most of those places that are like what we have are actually affiliated with the children's hospital. So the children's hospital in that state owns kind of a step down or a subacute hospital like ours. Ours is the only freestanding one here in Arizona and actually the only ones in Arizona.
Jennifer Frost is the administrator and director of nursing for Hacienda Children's Hospital. Their new facility in Mesa will be opening later this month. Jennifer, thank you.
No problem. Thank you, Mark.
Since 1875, the town of Superior, Arizona, has relied on mining to drive its economy. That reliance has come at a cost, though as many residents there have lived through several boom and bust cycles when nearby mines open and close. But town officials are now hoping to put an end to that cycle. KJZZ's Carrie Young has the story.
At the Save Money Market in Superior, Arizona, Michael Hing is doing one of his daily walkthroughs. He greets a few customers as he makes his way back to the produce section.
Hey, George. Hey, Dad.
With a population of just over 2,800 people, it's safe to say everyone knows each other here. Hing's family has been in town since the 1920s, when his grandfather first opened this grocery store. And Hing says it's that tight-knit nature that's helped the community weather the many economic downturns that have come with being a mining town.
I can't believe how my dad extended his credit line out to help the families in the community during the strikes and then even the shutdown.
Hing recounts a time in the 90s when the nearby Magma mine closed.
Superior was known at one time as Plywood City. The businesses were all boarded up. It just looked like a ghost town.
For him, the prospect of a new mine operated by Resolution Copper is good news because it promises to infuse the area with some much-needed economic activity. He adds this time around, he's hoping area leaders use some of that cash flow to reinvest in the town and explore the prospect of attracting other industries. Stephen Cooper, Superior's town attorney, says the plan is to grow the area's tourism industry.
We are certainly in the town of Superior trying to basically come to some agreement that would basically move the town away from a one-income employer.
He says leaders want to attract people who are already nearby, hiking the Arizona Trail, visiting the local arboretum, and driving through on US 60. Cooper acknowledged before any of that can happen, the town needs to invest in its infrastructure.
And we're hoping that we can basically use this opportunity to not repeat the mistakes of the past.
Local taxes on worker wages will provide some funding. He adds the town council is also hoping to negotiate a 0.1% tax on Resolution Copper's production.
No town really should be thinking, well, the mine's never going to close, because that's never been the case. Most mines have a useful life of at most a few decades. Some of them it's less than that.
Arizona State University economist Tom Reck says diversification is a feasible option for many mining towns in the state, but explains doing so requires a community to carefully consider its strengths and weaknesses, especially if it's in a remote location. He says what it comes down to is whether or not an area can bring in enough money from outside the community.
Oh, it's possible. It's not necessarily an easy task, and every mining community is different.
Rex says towns in Arizona have slowly been attempting to make this shift for about the last 40 years, but adds today the trend is picking up steam, thanks in part to improving transportation infrastructure, which allows residents to commute out of town for work and visitors to easily access an area for recreation, like, say, wine tasting.
So you're going to start with the Lei Lee. It's 100% Nebbiolo, and the fruit is from Graham County.
In central Arizona, the town of Jerome is one of a handful of towns that have successfully made the transition away from mining, with shops, restaurants, and wine tasting rooms like Caduceus Cellars lining the business district. Longtime resident and former mayor Richard Martin explains the tourism industry there took several decades to form.
When I first came to Jerome, you could walk down the middle of the street at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and nothing would happen. There were no cars, there was nothing.
And now, he says, you can barely find a parking space.
The town, you know, focused on the infrastructure, and it also focused on maintaining its historical heritage.
Back in Superior, grocer Michael Hing says he's hoping for something similar.
Everyone dreams of downtown Superior returning back like it was. Every shop filled. There was a clothing store. There was barber shops. There was all these amenities.
Hing realizes the town has a long road ahead. But he says right now, he's optimistic. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Sustainability isn't a word usually associated with professional sports or college athletic programs, especially when it comes to the length of careers. But a number of large schools, in fact, all of those in the Pac-12 conference, are working to be more sustainable by reducing their carbon footprint and improving their environmental performance. Arizona State is heavily involved in that effort, and as Pete Wozniak, manager of the university's athletic facilities, explains, the progress has been rapid.
We just started a recycling program within Sun Devil Athletics in 2007, so we're building from the ground up.
So when it comes to recycling at a game, I mean, let's say you've got a game at Sun Devil Stadium that is near a sellout. Let's say at least 60,000 people are there. What are some of the challenges that went into planning to make sure the recycling was effective, that people actually used it?
Well, it started from having a vendor who can haul the materials and recycle them. We've elevated that to now we're doing compost as well. So we're splitting into a few different streams. And over the years, that's evolving as well, where they can handle more and more different items and take them in different streams. For us, it was getting the bins in place throughout the stadium, signage. We have volunteers that are helping educate our fans, our cleaning crew. They go through and they separate our compostable materials to get contamination out. But within the stadium, we have a little more control on what comes in. It's outside the gates is what we're working on now of the things that we can't control. So we're working with our food service vendor for recyclable and compostable materials as well. So we're trying to control what's in the stadium.
Is that challenging, or are people really excited to work with you on that?
It's a challenge. No one likes change. We're building.
What have you found to be the biggest challenges going forward, and what are the things you found to be, hey, this actually has worked really well, maybe easier than I expected?
The easy one is recycling. Most people are recycling at home now. Throughout the stadiums, we all but eliminated our gray trash receptacles. We have some in the restrooms and at the gates, but throughout the facilities is either a green compost bin or a blue recycle bin. So your choices are either or. We're not throwing things in the trash. Our compost bins, after an event, our post-event cleanup crew, they go through and they pull contamination out of those. And so it's just compost because there's less tolerance in the compost bin for what can go and be composted.
When it comes to Sun Devil Stadium, first of all, are there any things that you know of based on the renovation of the stadium that might also be sort of in that green territory, that sort of feeling of, hey, we want things, whether it's building materials or whether it's sort of the direction it goes, anything related to being more green when it comes to that?
Right now in this first phase of construction with Hunt Sun being the contractor, they are shooting for lead silver on that project.
Okay.
So a lot of the materials from the demolition have been separated and go to their various streams, whether it's metal or concrete or wood. So it's all been going out that way, and the new materials brought in also. LED lighting, efficient air conditioning units, and just more efficient products in there.
Pete Wozniak is manager of ASU's athletic facilities.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. An ape is trying to climb on a pole that's 60 feet high. Due to the slippery surface, the ape climbs 3 feet in a minute, only to slip back 2 feet. How much time will it take the ape to reach the top? Hint, the answer is not 60 minutes. When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Very local in Valley traffic, accidents I-17 northbound at Camelback, also I-10 eastbound at 27th Avenue. We expect skies to clear tonight, no mention of rain in the forecast. Look for overnight lows to be around 80. For tomorrow, we should have sunny skies and a high around 102. Currently, relative humidity is at 17%, and it's 101 degrees at 249.
KJZZ is supported by the Grand Highland Hotel, a boutique experience located on Prescott's historic Whiskey Row, featuring the Holiday Courtyard, a place to enjoy summer events, weddings, and live music. More at GrandHighlandHotel.com.
Water worries continue to grip the Southwest, but for one business near Lake Mead, the historic drought on the Colorado River is beginning to reveal underwater artifacts that few have ever seen. KJZZ's Will Stone takes us there.
July 1948, a B-29 zips over the remote waters of Lake Mead's upper basin. It's a secret test mission for a missile guidance system. Except the pilots misjudge the altitude. The massive bomber plunges into the lake. The crew survives, but the plane is lost. Nearly 70 years later, another crew stands not far from there, watching the unfolding of a much slower-moving disaster.
All of this was underwater at least 5 years ago. This particular launch ramp that we're on right now didn't exist. It used to start all the way up about a mile and a quarter up the hill.
Joel Silverstein runs Tech Diving Limited, which has exclusive access to the submerged remains of that mission gone awry. In recent years, he's watched the waterline creep back, exposing chalky rings and islands unseen since the lake was filled. This is all due to the historic drought in the Colorado River Basin. The marina here now sits abandoned in a dry gully. Steve Brown is one of the divers coming to see the bomber.
Seeing this lake as a child in the 80s and now seeing it, it just makes my jaw drop. To say I'm scared now to see it is actually, a realistic statement.
Lake Mead has been hitting record lows throughout the year, raising the specter of water cutbacks for Arizona and Nevada in the near future. The upshot for these scuba divers, though, is that the underwater wreckage is easier to explore, as Silverstein explains on the boat ride out.
On its crash, it sank in approximately 260 feet of water, and that's exceptionally deep for scuba diving.
Now it's less than 130 feet, meaning more light and divers need less training. Silverstein has gone wreck diving all over the world and says the B-29 stands out. For one, the cool, fresh water has kept the plane in remarkably good condition.
That plane has never seen air since 1948. Everything in there, every control that's inside of it, is in its original position.
Soon, Silverstein and the crew are wriggling into heavy insulated wetsuits, fastening straps and straddling tanks of nitrox. By the end, they look like astronauts, not out of place in the moonscape of Lake Mead.
This is the National Park Service.
Yes, we're just calling in to let you know that we're diving on the B-29 bomber.
That's John Fuller, the boat's captain. Bobbing in the water gives Steve Brown a sort of dry run before the descent.
Second place where an engine used to be,
okay.
And look at the gigantic hole with all the pipes and tubes and wires and all the stuff. You're thinking, man.
At the time of its inception during World War II, the B-29 was a major leap forward for American military aviation. It could carry out bombing campaigns in the Pacific and was eventually entrusted with nuclear weapons.
This is the B-29, the plane you've been waiting for, and it was worth waiting for. It's the biggest, fastest, mightiest heavy bomber in the world.
There's only one operational B-29 left in the world today. From video taken below, you can see the propellers lodged into the silty bottom, the cracked fuselage caked in mussels, and the cockpit with the remains of a parachute, aglow in green murky light. Eventually, the divers resurface, Adam Christopher among them.
came upon the tail, and then went around port side, around the wing to the only remaining propeller, which is also quite large, but it's bent as if it hit the water.
Since the plane was discovered in the early 2000s, the National Park Service and only about 60 people have dived the bomber. There aren't any plans to pull it out of the water anytime soon either. Silverstein says he finds something new every time, but this dive, the biggest surprise wasn't some old artifact.
Hit a maximum depth on it today of about 102 feet. Last time we were on it, we had a maximum depth of about 108. So we're seeing more water drying up here in Lake Mead than ever before.
It's a frightening development that Silverstein and all the Southwest, for that matter, hope will reverse course soon. Until then, though, it's a chance to dive deep into a history that few have ever seen like this. Will Stone, KJZZ News, reporting from Lake Mead.
The valley's monsoon storms can feature sky-blasting lightning, earth-shaking thunder, and walls of dust. Some people just turn up the volume on the TV to block out the storms, but many others go toward the activity, hoping to capture it on their cameras and phones. Brian Snyder is a storm chaser and weather documentarian who gets especially excited about the monsoon. Brian, what are you seeing when you see the storm? Do you say to yourself, I want to make this look a certain way to help people who see the photo feel the way I do experiencing it in person?
I always have kind of a personal goal, which has been kind of founded by a friend of mine. His name's Larry Reeves, and he said, go out and find landscapes that happen to have weather. So when I see, you know, lightning pop up on a radar or different things like that, I see that as an opportunity to capture Arizona in a very unique way. You know, a lot of people think of Arizona as being a hot, dry, you know, desert wasteland. And when I can capture our landscapes, which I think are awesome, beautiful, that happen to have weather, then I think I get two elements that people don't expect.
Is it more exciting to shoot when there's, I mean, you talk about the beautiful landscape, so is it more exciting for you to shoot when there's something really actively going on?
As a storm chaser and a storm photographer, we all, you know, mark our calendars for June 15th when the monsoon actually officially begins. But I think it's just one of those things that, you know, this time of year is special because, you know, most of the time there's not a cloud in the sky. So if you go to the Grand Canyon, even if you're not seeing a massive lightning storm, there's still clouds. It creates shadows. It creates lots of different opportunities to capture, you know, a magnificent landscape like the Grand Canyon that you normally wouldn't get to see, you know, other parts of the year.
How far are you willing to go, Brian, as far as like, are you willing to go from one side of town to the other to make sure you get the shot?
Oh, yeah. The last 3 days, I've driven probably close to 1,500 miles just to try to get the shot. The first day, I went to the Grand Canyon and had hopes of capturing a storm up there, and unfortunately, it didn't quite work out. And then the day before that, I went to Winslow. Same, you know, intentions. And the thing with the monsoon, it's not an exact science. And you can see a meteorologist actually getting frustrated 2 weeks in already because the night that we got the epic lightning, that was kind of expected, but I don't think on that scale. I think with the monsoon, it really has a mind of its own. The storms can really do whatever they want. And I think that's what's kind of fun about it is that here I am getting ready to go to bed like a lot of storm chasers were the other night and when we got that lightning in Phoenix, or excuse me, the East Valley of Phoenix, and I just happened to look at radar and I'm like, wait, there's storms. And I go out and shoot all night. So it's, you know, you got to be willing. Kind of the mindset that I have is, you know, back in January, would I be willing to drive out to the East Valley to capture lightning? And the answer would be yes. So during the monsoon, if it means I got to constantly drive, you know, 1,500 miles to capture weather, then that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. As you said, the monsoon can vary through parts of the area. But I'm wondering, are there certain places where you go, if the monsoon's going on, boy, it's hard to not take a great shot?
I find that the farming fields just around Eloy or, you know, Coolidge offer a unique landscape because it's almost like if I show somebody a picture, they look and say, oh, that looks like the Midwest. Of course, I'm going to see a thunderstorm. But then they see mountains behind it, and it kind of throws them a curveball because it looks like Kansas, but yet it's not. And so I find kind of those areas are fun to shoot, and there's usually, you know, frequent weather down there, or at least there's a good chance. But also, I think northern Arizona offers a very unique opportunity to shoot Arizona. I love, you know, kind of the I-40 corridor between Winslow and Flagstaff. I think that's always has produced some pretty good results for me as well.
They're probably all your babies to some extent, but there are a couple either photos you've shot or aspects of a film you've shot where you were just like, I'm so glad I got this because this is one of those that seemed unique, or I might never be able to catch something like this again.
You know, actually, a couple days ago, you know, it was probably my 10th, 11th, 12th time of going to the Grand Canyon to capture a storm. And unfortunately, I've only had a one-hit wonder there. That was the very first time, July 5th, 2013, I captured a lightning bolt into the Grand Canyon at sunset. And that's just been an image in my mind that I replay over and over again because I know how long I had to wait to get that. Mm-hmm. But I also know how I've tried and tried so many times afterwards to not have any success whatsoever up there. And so that's an image that I'm really proud of just because, you know, I captured an iconic Arizona landscape.
Brian Snyder is a storm chaser, also a weather documentarian. Brian, thanks for coming in.
Hey, no problem. Thank you.
Be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. Among the stories we'll have for you, how active is Arizona when it comes to clinical trials? And we'll talk with the director of a new documentary about battling drug cartels. Those stories and much, much, much more tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on the show.
If you're a night owl looking for some stuff to do on a Thursday, for some of us it's a school night, so we might not be going out
yes.
more. But Improv Uncensored tonight at 7:30, National Comedy Theater in Mesa.
You can also check out Rob Thomas. He'll be performing tonight, and that's at Comerica Theater.
One of Mark's favorites at Chars Has the Blues tonight in Phoenix at 9. It's Lady J.
Of course. The show is produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, and Regina Revazova. Sorry, Regina. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director, Al Macias, executive producer, John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. If you have any good story ideas, we could use some. We're at the show at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. It's member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered up next at 3 o'clock.